U.S. health officials have made their first confirmation of the presence of a deadly fungus in one of three lots of steroids tied to a national meningitis outbreak as the death toll rose to 20 yesterday. The staff of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention are working furiously to identify and notify some 14,000 people across 16 states, including New York, who may have received the contaminated medication. And the U.S. Food and Drug Administration is testing other drugs manufactured by the lab responsible for the contaminated compound, the New England Compounding Center, or NECC, in Massachusetts. We thought it would be a good idea to devote today's Please Explain segment to investigating what fungal meningitis is, how it's contracted, and how scientists are tracking this current outbreak. And joining us are Dr. William Schaffner, professor of preventive medicine and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University. He's also president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. And Dr. Emil Hiesiger, a clinical associate professor of neurology at the NYU School of Medicine. Welcome to our show.
Good to be with you, Leonard.
And we also invite our listeners to join in the discussion by calling us at 212-433-9692 or leaving a question on our show page at WNYC.org. Let's begin with you, Emil Hiesiger. What is meningitis? We often hear spinal meningitis. Is fungal meningitis very different?
Meningitis is an inflammation of the or infection of the covering of the brain and the spinal cord. The public uses the word spinal meningitis. It doesn't, in fact, exist. If the meninges are infected, the entire system is infected from the bottom of the spinal cord, which is in the lower back, all the way up to the top of the head in the front of the brain over the eyes. The whole system is infected. I think the public uses the word spinal meningitis because they knew that if doctors thought they had meningitis, they would get something called the spinal tap or lumbar puncture, in which a needle is put into the lower part of the back to take out some fluid and see if, in fact, it is infected. And because of that, it was called a spinal tap. They called it spinal meningitis. But, in fact, meningitis deals with the inflammation or infection of the entire nervous system covering.
Bill,
meningitis is the word meningitis comes from meninges, which are the words, which is the word that describes that covering.
Bill Schaffner, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration said it was still testing two additional lots of. Now I'm going to be brave here and say some of these words: methylprednisolone acetate.
Yeah, that's a steroid preparation.
And then, and some other injectable drugs that were supplied by the New England Compounding Center for the presence of this rare fungus. And I'm not sure how to pronounce it, the Exerohilum fungus?
Yeah, well, that's pretty good. Exerohilum.
Okay. How rare is that fungus? Because I keep on hearing it's a rare fungus.
I'll tell you how rare it is. It doesn't appear in conventional medical textbooks. That's how rarely it causes disease. Now, it's out in the environment. It causes rot in wood, and it's not what we call a professional pathogen. It doesn't go around making people sick except as in this extraordinarily unusual circumstance.
Where it seems to be especially aggressive in attacking tissues in the spine and brainstem.
Well, you see, this fungus and perhaps some others were in contaminating this steroid, which was inoculated right next to the meninges, as was just mentioned, and they kind of worked their way into the central nervous system, causing this serious infection.
The images that have been taken through a microscope that have been published all look very different from each other. Are there different kinds of funguses at work here?
Well, at the moment, three different kinds of fungi have been implicated. I don't think we have to. One of them is Aspergillus. One is this Exerholum, and the other one is called Cladosporium, sorry. And all of them are very unusual causes of human disease.
Emil, as I understand it, the people who are most vulnerable are the ones who have already have compromised immune systems. So
That's true. But in this case, as my colleague just mentioned, you took perfectly normal people who were suffering from pain. In this case, it was back pain. The injectate, the material that the doctors were injecting was called an epidural, was designed to put the steroid in an area in the back, usually the lower back, where they had a disc herniation or something, and with the idea that the steroid would bathe the nerve roots that were being squeezed by the disc herniation. And what steroids do in that case is a nerve root under pressure actually does the worst thing it could do. It holds water and swells, making it hurt even more. And if you put steroids around it, it actually takes the water out of the nerve root. It shrinks, and the patients feel better until nature takes its course in about 80% of cases, and the disc desiccates and lifts itself off the nerve that was causing you to have sciatica. So there's a reason to give some of these injections. The problem in this case is they injected something that had, in a closed space, in this covering around the spine, and it was a wonderful place for it to have a party and grow, and it invaded through the outside of the covering of the spine into the inside, getting involved with the meninges, and the rest is history. And indeed, one of the ways that this does infect people, and occasionally when they get it in nature, if they go to a barn full of dust, or if they happen to have they can get it from the dust, they can get it from stored corn, this is rare, but they can get it. And people who are immunocompromised, that is, have AIDS or chemotherapy or something like that, they would get it perhaps more readily, but not necessarily as a meningitis. And you should know today, there was reported, I think in Long Island, a young man who was injected with a steroid because his ankle hurt, and he got aspergillosis that began in the joint of the ankle. He's obviously not as sick as someone that gets the meningitis. The meningitis is a very serious disease that can cause, in a short period of time, death. It can be associated with an abscess of the brain, which is pus within the brain. It can damage the blood vessels, which is how meningitis ultimately makes most of us. Infectious meningitis of this kind can cause strokes, major strokes, hemorrhages within the brain or outside the brain, within the skull. And because it damages the blood vessels as it invades them, it can cause a weakening in the walls of the blood vessels, so they rupture. That's how the blood gets out. And the treatment for it is not, first of all, it's a strong, rather toxic treatment, and it doesn't always work as well as we'd like. And so it's not, you may say, well, why don't you just give everyone that may have been exposed to it the treatment in advance? Because it wouldn't work, and not the treatment is quite aggressive. It would be inappropriate to do that. You should also understand that there are 350 types of aspergillosis, and most of them are totally benign. They grow on bread, potatoes, mildew. It's used in commercial preparations to make the rice wine called sake and citric acid. They're not all bad. Just a few of them can cause the diseases that we're talking about. And again, a whole lot of this was injected in a place that it normally wouldn't go, and in an amount that normally wouldn't be there without this kind of contaminated injecting.
Now, Bill, I've heard that the injections were primarily given as epidural to older patients. Would they be more vulnerable? Because we've had 20 deaths, but it's assumed that something like 14,000 people have been injected. And I guess there have been 200 or 300 cases that have popped up so far, people who've been affected.
Well, older people are the people who are more likely to have back pain and require just exactly the kind of treatment that Emil has indicated. And some of those people have underlying illnesses such that if they were to develop the meningitis, surely would have a much harder time recovering. Because once you get a serious illness like meningitis, if you have underlying heart disease or lung disease, that can also be adversely affected.
I read that one researcher said, we don't want to have 80-year-olds hallucinating, which is what we're seeing. Is hallucination one of the symptoms?
Well, when you have inflammation of those coverings of the brain, you get swelling, fluid drawn into the cranial cavity, which is held fast because of the solid skull. That pushes pressure onto the brain, and that can adversely influence central nervous system functioning. So you can become confused, and you can then eventually even drift into coma.
My guests are Dr. William Schaffner, Professor of Preventive Medicine and Chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University, and Dr. Emil Hiesiger, a Clinical Associate Professor of Neurology at the NYU School of Medicine. We are talking about fungal meningitis, which is in the news these days. on today's Please Explain. Emil, we've been hearing that treatment is essential right away because if someone is infected through this means of transmission, injected and an injection into the spine or a joint, the disease can progress incredibly rapidly. What are the treatments we generally hear for this form of meningitis?
There's a drug, and Bill, you can correct me if I'm out of date with this, but they still, I believe, use amphotericin, which is a drug that's been used for treatment of this for a long time.
Is that an antibiotic?
Yes, and then that there are other antifungal agents that have, when that doesn't work well enough, that can help 50 to 65% of patients that weren't helped sufficiently by the amphotericin. Amphotericin was given in the vein and also has to be given by what you call a spinal tap to right into the fluid of the that's infected. And at times, another treatment that has to occur, some of these people may get an abscess of the brain, which is a collection of pus, like a pimple on your face, but it's quite large. And those abscesses have to be drained because they take up space within the confines of the skull and could actually cause the brain to to push the brain out of the skull down into the where the spine is. That would result in death. So to take the pressure off, they sometimes have to drain abscesses. And that solves the pressure problem, but doesn't solve the infectious problem per se.
You wanted to add to that, Bill?
Well, Emil is exactly right. There are basically two drugs. Amphotericin is one. There's another newer one called voriconazole. Fancy names for two drugs that are specific antifungals. They have to be given intravenously. They're tricky drugs to use because they're toxic. That is, they have serious side effects on other bodily organs, particularly the kidney and the liver. And it is likely that the treatment will have to be quite prolonged. And when I say prolonged, I mean weeks into months. The hope is that patients can be stabilized in the hospital, then transferred home, and they could get intravenous therapy by coming to a hospital or clinic, and even perhaps shifted to an oral form by mouth of voriconazole.
But you say that these are very toxic and they may cause other kinds of damage. So will we be seeing other kinds of problems down the line?
Well, whenever anyone gets sick and requires hospital care, that can initiate a cascade of adverse events. But I think the point I'm trying to make is that the average physician doesn't know how to use these drugs. These have been the province largely of infectious diseases specialists, and organizing the care for all of these people, which is tricky, that's a challenge.
We also have been hearing, Emil, that it'll be months before we'll know how many people have been affected. Why does this disease take over and destroy the brain in 10 days for some, while for others it takes months to show up?
To me, it's not clear. It may have to do, and Bill, you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, it may have to do with the possibly with the amount of this is a mold. A fungus is a mold. The amount of mold, and if you think about it, that is injected in any particular lot. So the doctor has a vial that holds, let's just arbitrarily say, 10 milliliters or a certain number of ounces. He takes a small amount of this, puts it in with whatever he wants to do, and gives an epidural. I guess it's a function of how much is in that injectable material in that particular bottle, in that particular lot. And also, I don't know, Bill, you can correct me, it may have to do with maybe there's a variable degree of pathogenicity or virulence or of some of the pathogens of aspergillosis and as well as the two other fungi that you mentioned.
Well, Amy, that's correct. And in addition, what we've discovered is that these vials are kept normally on a shelf. The longer they're kept on the shelf, the more the fungi were able to multiply within the vial. Thus, the higher dose that was inoculated, the more likely you are then to become sick.
Now, I was wondering why we are seeing high incidences in some states, less in others. Mm-hmm. Tennessee had 63 cases, Indiana 34, Virginia 37, New Jersey had 13, New York State had 1.
The contaminated lots were not uniformly distributed, and in our state, we got the largest shipment of the contaminated lots. Hence, we have still
Tennessee,
the largest number of patients in Tennessee.
But every state would use the same kind of treatment of an epidural. It's just you wound up with the unlucky group of medicines.
Exactly. The contaminated vials were not uniformly distributed across the country.
We have to take a little break, and when we come back, we will continue this conversation, find out about compounding pharmacies and what some of those other terms that we've been hearing about actually mean. And we will be taking your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692 if you want to get into the conversation. You can also write to our show page at WNYC.org to ask your questions of Dr. Emil Heisiger, Clinical Associate Professor of Neurology at the NYU School of Medicine, and Dr. William Schaffner, Professor of Preventive Medicine and Chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University in Tennessee. He's also the President of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Stay with us. Our guests on today's Please Explain, which is a look at fungal meningitis, much in the news, but I'm sure rather confusing to you because it is complicated. So we've asked two experts to explain, Dr. Emil Heisiger, a clinical associate professor of neurology at the NYU School of Medicine, and Dr. William Schaffner, professor of preventive medicine and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University, also president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, to explain. I wonder about the drug itself. Can you explain, Bill, what the drug that was contaminated was supposed to do?
It's a steroid, and it reduces inflammation. So just as Emil described previously, the affected nerve, which is pinched and dysfunctional, causing pain, gets soothed, as it were, and the pain is relieved.
It's called methylprednisolone acetate.
Yes.
That's really complicated, but if I look at it, I guess I can see what some of the components of it are. Is this a compound?
Yeah, surely it's a compound, and it's a steroid compound. We use steroids all the time to help deal with inflammation in various parts of the body. Here it was highly localized.
Sean from New Jersey has asked on our show page, what's the importance of these compounding pharmacies regarding keeping drug prices lower? Emil?
Actually, I'm not sure that the prices are higher or lower than those drugs that come from what you would call big pharma, the major pharmaceutical firms. I think the role, they may be cheaper, but I certainly also know that sometimes compounding pharmacies are used by physicians who ask a special compound to be made for them because they believe that that compound is, which is a variant on something that already exists in the market, may be more efficacious, better for the patient than that which is commercially available.
And is this a compound pharmacy? Is this a compound, the thing we've been discussing?
Yes, but it's a steroid. It's methylprednisolone. How that compound is actually made, there are several ways that presumably it could be made, and how it's actually made, and it's made, you know, commercially in big vats and such, and how it's made, the technique by which it's made, the accuracy of the manufacturing. Does it have in it what it says it has in it exactly as it's supposed to, and is it sterile? Is it clean? All of that has to be dealt with when it's made and commercially distributed. As I understand it, it may be cheaper to buy from some of these compounding pharmacies, but of course you see what the price of being cheaper is. It may be contaminated.
Yeah,
in my experience as a physician, the only time I've dealt with compounding pharmacies, I don't use these. I don't use them and never would. But dermatologists sometimes want special creams and ointments to be made, and they ask a compounding pharmacy to mix things together for their particular patient. Had that been done in this case, and even if you had some aspergillosis on your skin, I'm not sure you would have certainly gotten sick from it. Certainly you may not have gotten meningitis, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about an injectable substance that is going to be used for the purposes of treating pain in the spine, as we talked about, or as we saw today recently, treating joint pain. If someone with a bad knee, a bad shoulder, a bad ankle in the case in New York, I believe it was, they inject some of the steroid to reduce inflammation in the joint. It's like taking a super aspirin, if you will, by injecting it in the joint.
Well, we know about epidurals because they're often used in pregnancies. But, Bill, you wanted to add something to that?
Well, I wanted to say that, as Emil said, originally the concept of a compounding pharmacy was all pharmacists are trained to compound, that is, to make up special medications custom tailored for an individual patient's need. And these pharmacies discovered that actually they could do this on a very, very large scale, and they became mini manufacturing plants. And indeed, cost was an issue. They could provide these compounds less expensively than the large pharmaceutical manufacturers, but they avoided the oversight reach of the Food and Drug Administration.
Because they regulated on the state level rather than on the federal level?
They're overseen at the state level. Most states really don't have the expertise or the resources to genuinely regulate them. Now, it gets into a bit of a legal thicket, and the question is, why didn't the Food and Drug Administration regulate these large mini-manufacturing plants more effectively?
Is NECC the only supplier of this medication?
Oh, no, there are other suppliers also, regular pharmaceutical firms, for example.
Is the second tier of the medical system somehow is that what this is involved with here, or do all doctors prescribe medications from these compounding pharmacies on occasion?
I think what we're learning is that these compounding pharmacies have a much larger reach than we had anticipated. And NECC created drugs of many kinds that were distributed in all 50 states.
And are they manufacturing them all, Emil, or are they also obtaining medications from other countries like China and India?
I'm not sure. I know they manufacture certainly the agents in question. I don't know if they act as a distributor from other countries or not. That I don't know. The problem, I just want to emphasize this, that there are two forms of controls. A big pharmaceutical firm, for lots of reasons, has a very big quality assurance system built into it. They inspect what they produce on a regular basis for all the things I told you. Did they, in fact, make the right drug in the right way, and is it sterile? And so I'm not sure that that kind of oversight exists within these compounding pharmacies. One reason, it may be cheaper, if it is. And secondly, the why is there no federal oversight? As I understand it, the group of compounding pharmacies that exist in the United States has politically pushed back, saying that our states can take care of it. And state health departments, first of all, we're in a tremendous economic downturn. Governments are suffering at all levels in terms of ability to do what they're supposed to do. And state health departments are not quite geared up like the FDA to do this. And indeed, if they did start to do it, they'd have to charge. There would be a charge associated with this. I don't mean they'd build a pharmacy, but it comes out of the taxes and of the state taxes. And so, based on the wealth of the state and how much money could be diverted to looking at these pharmacies and to surveilling them in a meaningful way, could be quite expensive. And yet, as I understand it, the compounding pharmacies have resisted attempts to be better regulated through the federal government by the FDA.
But the FDA winds up getting involved when something like this happens.
Yes, it does. The question will be, and there'll be congressional hearings about this, about whether the FDA should, going forward, have the same kind of oversight on these compounding pharmacies that they do on regular pharmaceutical firms.
How do they retrace them? How do they find out that it was this NECC rather than any number of other compounding pharmacies?
So what happened is that a young physician at Vanderbilt made the association between fungal meningitis and a specific clinic. She reported that to the Tennessee Department of Health, which then did a very immediate and incisive investigation that revealed the clinic was fine, but they were using an apparently contaminated medication. That then caused the Centers for Disease Control and the FDA to get involved, and the whole investigation opened up.
We have some callers calling in. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. And Robert from New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Yes, my situation was I was hospitalized for what was presumed to be meningitis. The MRI showed significant swelling of the brain and the spinal cord. I was there for 3 weeks treated with an IV, but when they did an LP, nothing showed up, although, you know, I suffered severe neurological damage, difficulties walking, cognitive disorders, basically everything you're talking about. So the question is, are there aspects of this that are hard to identify even in an LP?
Yes, there are. The LP undoubtedly showed evidence of inflammation, but when sent to the clinical microbiology laboratory, nothing grew. And that's because the clinical microbiology laboratory would have to put it on special media for the fungi to actually grow. And this has been a regular problem in this fungal meningitis. These fungi don't like to grow on the delicious media that we provide them in the micro labs.
Okay?
Yeah.
Thank you for calling us. A caller wonders, can the medicine be pasteurized or sterilized without impairing its effectiveness?
There are ways to sterilize medication terminally. That's right. And there is a whole array, a large book of good manufacturing practices that institutions, compounding pharmacies and others have to adhere to.
Do we have any sense of how these medicines could have been contaminated? I mean, we're talking about this rare fungus that attacks woods.
We're going to wait the
grasses,
results.
I gather,
yes,
too.
Yes, right. Woods, et cetera, leaves, leaf mold. We're waiting for the results of the Food and Drug Administration investigation to tell us exactly what went wrong in this pharmacy.
But we don't know. Our number again, 212-433-9692. You can You can call it. I am on automatic pilot sometimes. Anyway, you can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. It's the same place where you can pledge. And we are taking a call now from Bob from Rico Park. Hi, Bob. You're on the air.
Leonard, how you doing? I love pledging. I do it every month. Great show.
You do it every month? Wow, you're better than most people.
Of course. Great show and great station. Leonard, my question is, in the New York Times, I read an article. They specifically stated that because alcohol was not placed with the steroid, that allowed the fungus to grow. Is it true that if alcohol was placed with the steroid, there would have never been problems, and the negligence was because of not placing alcohol with the steroid?
That was a matter of speculation. I think we're not entirely sure, because these were single-use medications for only one patient, and many of those medications have no preservative inherently in them.
Indeed, Leonard. Mm-hmm. Most preservatives are quite toxic to the nervous system. If you took even when you use anesthetic, like Novocaine in layman's terms, the anesthetic that's used in an injection like the epidural you described for a pregnancy for control of pain, it must be preservative free. The anesthetic is quite safe. The preservatives are quite toxic to the nervous system, and they actually could permanently damage nerves or the spinal cord.
Aren't some of them mercury based? Like the Myrisol?
Oh, that's in vaccines. That would not relate to these products.
No, that's a separate issue. But an alcohol, in fact, is exceedingly neurotoxic. It is used intentionally in treatment at times to destroy nerves to cure certain painful conditions. But you would not want to put alcohol in an epidural. It would have an absolutely disastrous outcome. So I can't believe that anyone would use alcohol as part of a steroid mixture, unless it was used initially as part of the original manufacturing and then somehow taken out of the mixture.
Now, Carolyn in Queens asks, would it have been possible to see the fungi in the vials that could have alerted the personnel that something wasn't quite right?
You know, that's a very good question, Carol. Yeah. And under most circumstances, not. But I will tell you that the Food and Drug Administration, when it first went into this compounding pharmacy, found some vials that were visibly contaminated, indicating a really very large degree of contamination in at least those vials.
But nobody was looking for them.
Well, again, when you talk about looking at the vials, we're talking about mold. It could look like what you would call mold on a bread or on a tomato or something, or on a potato. It could look on like that. And so in some cases, if there were a lot of fungi or mold, you could see it in the vial, but it would have to be a lot.
Let's take another call. Deborah from Newark, New Jersey. Hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. I want to address the matter of why state oversight of compounding pharmacies instead of federal, because that really is the nub of this issue. The mandate for compounding pharmacies and why it is limited to state-level oversight is that a compounding pharmacy must have a script for a patient for one-time production of a med. And you're talking about all these individual doses. And what NEC did is they went into mass production, like Pfizer or Roche, and that is outside of their regulated mandate. And so all this discussion of could we have seen it or this or that, well, they weren't supposed to be doing it anyway. So they were operating under state oversight as a compounding pharmacy, but operating on a national level, mass producing meds that they were not equipped or regulated to do. And that's why they didn't have federal oversight.
Well, Deborah is exactly right. According to what's been reported, that would have been required by Massachusetts, that they have a specific script for every distinctive medication that they were providing. And apparently that was not the case. But we'll hear more about that as the investigation proceeds.
A number of callers have called in because they're concerned that they're about to undergo treatment, or one says, I got steroid shots in the knee a month ago. Am I at risk? What symptoms should I look for?
The plan has been and continues to be that because we know all the clinics that received the contaminated material, those clinics and those state health departments are in the process of contacting all the individual patients who have received that material. If you have any concern, I think you ought to check with your clinic, with your doctor, have you used material from the New England Compounding Center? And I want to tell you, those calls are avalanching into offices across the country, quite understandably and appropriately.
Now, Justin asks, what alternatives are there to steroid injections for back pain? Are there? Emil?
Yes. Yes, there are. You can take... First of all, you can, in my practice, before I inject someone, I always have them, almost always have them try steroids by mouth for 2 weeks. And that's an obvious alternative. The pills are not likely to be poorly manufactured or contaminated in such a way.
Are they more likely to have been made by a pharmaceutical that is federally regulated?
Probably, and I certainly, I would never deal with a compounding pharmacy for a whole litany of reasons. This is just part of them. But yes, I would try oral steroids first. If you do have to inject steroids, they're efficacious, at least in the short term, and then Mother Nature often takes over. You should only buy the steroids from a major pharmaceutical firm that has a long history of making them. And finally, I don't know what the cost difference is, Baby Bill does, between a 40 milligram per kilogram bottle of a steroid coming out of a compounding pharmacy such as this versus the same drug made by Bristol-Myers Squibb or Pfizer or Roche or whatever it is.
Bill, do you know? Well, I've seen various estimates, but it's not trivial.
Mm-hmm. So, now, a listener, Jan, asks whether says that he has meningitis, but he is having laser therapy. Is that another way of dealing with this? Have you heard about that?
I don't know what that is.
I'm not familiar with that either.
I don't see how it could work. The laser has to be in contact with the target. The target would be the meninges.
Yeah,
and that just doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, there's some confusion there.
Is there a finite number of steroid injections that you can receive?
It's a matter of judgment. People that really use a lot of epidural steroids may, for a chronic condition, give a series of three in a year or something of that nature. Is there a finite number? No, but at some point you will end up asking the question, if I have to use all these invasive epidural steroid injections for something and it doesn't seem to be holding the patient or making them definitively better, perhaps you should consider something else. else, like finally going for surgery, which is often the needed, or putting patients on some kind of other ways of controlling their pain. You asked about pain medication would help many of these people, such as either non-steroidals or which are like naproxen or something, or perhaps in older people particularly who tend to get stomach upset from that, even mild or moderate narcotics. It could be used for the control of some of the kinds of pain that these people have. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, steroids are often used too frequently in injections because doctors are loath to prescribe narcotics because of all the hullabaloo that occurred about OxyContin, et cetera, and made doctors afraid to write narcotic prescriptions. Indeed, especially in states in the South like Tennessee where there was a lot of abuse of OxyContin.
We've kind of run out of time, unfortunately, but I'm going to give you the last word, Bill.
This is an ongoing issue. We are still seeing patients coming to diagnosis and treatment, and so I think that this problem will be in the news with us for some time coming.
Thank you both so much for participating in today's Please Explain. Bill Schaffner, a professor of preventive medicine and chair of the Department of Preventive Medicine at Vanderbilt University, also president of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases, and Dr. Emil Hiesiger, a clinical associate professor of neurology at the NYU School of Medicine.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much for having me.